Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Serge.
Let's continue that discussion we had last time about free software and how money plays into that.
Yeah, we deluded ourselves into thinking it would be one episode, but very quickly realized there's so much to discuss.
Yeah, so let's dive into it. The distinction we made last time was we said that the models for funding free software were on a spectrum of completely charity on one end and completely profit-oriented business on the other. And we gave some examples of more charity-ish structures, and we said that this time we would talk more about the more business-oriented structures around free software funding.
Yep, so and the same caveat we gave last time is that a lot of the things we're going to talk about in this category are sometimes done by nonprofits, just as in the other one, a lot of the ones are done by what we would, you know, say non-charity businesses. So
yeah, we're focused more on, I think the way I would look at it is we're focused on methods here, the method of fundraising rather or the method of fiscal distribution rather than the tax structure of the organization doing the work.
Right. So at the last episode, we decided to not tackle the topic and left it as a teaser. So what was that topic?
I think it was academia, wasn't it?
The 20% time and the academia stuff, time. We decided to kind of roll it into one.
That's right. Right. So when we think, so let's actually, I think it's easier to discuss the 20% because academia is so tricky and gets complicated. Right. So do you want to explain the 20%?
Okay. Let's talk about the mythical 20%, and then we can discuss how it actually tends to play out in practice. So the mythical 20%, I think, was popularized by Google, who had this 20% project thing, and they said, you know, you get 20% of your time, you can work on whatever you want. And that sounds dramatically exciting to many free software developers, right? So, you know, like, oh, 20% time for anything I want. That's one day a week I get to spend on my favorite free software project, right? In reality, I think what very often ends up happening is you get this, you know, that gets discussed, but other things end up taking priority. And very often, if it's not kind of a core part of your job, usually that gets bumped off first if you're in a crunch. And many software development houses are always in a crunch.
Yeah, I think there are actually a couple of parts to this. So first of all, yeah, the very early Google idea was that they wanted to fund what they called innovation, and you know what they said was they wanted to fund innovation. So they said that the way to do that was to treat Google like a bit of a brain trust, and to keep it fresh, they would say, okay, if you come to work for Google, you can take 20% of your time and work on whatever thing you think is worthwhile. But that's Google a long time ago. So that has changed from articles that I've read. And I'm not going to say that Googlers have told me this, but knowing Googlers, I don't think that they're spending 20% of their time on these projects. But from public articles that have come out about this, as you say, this has changed in a number of ways. So first of all, now these projects have to be somewhat more directed, and they have to be experimental with the idea that they might turn into a product. Secondly, you know, as Google has grown, the type of talent that they've brought in has changed, and so they have people that are not as they're not all software developers. They'll have, you know, people that are doing other tasks, you know, marketing, but even, you know, site reliability engineers and things like that. And so they may or may not have those 20% opportunities either. And I don't know if the 20% was ever supposed to be used for the for free software development or maintenance. My understanding was that it was always just kind of an experimental thing, kind of like a hackathon or a game jam or something like that, where a company is just trying to see what kind of ideas they can get out of people to be the next big thing. So that's the mythical, sorry, I went on a big tangent there, but this mythical idea of a 20% being used for free software, I don't know if that was ever really the case.
Well, I do know that a number of, this is really not a Google episode, right? But I do know that some stuff did make it upstream because of that 20%, flexibility. But I think that it's not as common as the vision of it is, and I think it's decreasingly common. And I think that also we're not trying to talk about Google specifically, or actually even specifically the 20% time as being a specific thing that companies implement, but kind of that general idea that, oh yeah, we're going to hire you, and some of your time you're going to get to work on the stuff you want.
I think that's right. And so the way that gets expressed, it was formalized in this 20% rule, but as you say, this is when you're trying to attract top talent, in the same way that these large companies and institutions will have a really nice campus, they might have nice dining services or other things. This idea that you can follow your passion is very attractive.
Right. So what I think often ends up happening in reality is that very often some company will be using something, and this is much more common, and they need some sort of feature. And one of the team developers on the team says, well, we could make that feature happen. And it actually is in the company's interest to get that stuff upstream because it's much less difficult than maintaining a fork. And that does happen quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this isn't discussed as much in free software circles as it actually happens. So when people discuss free software funding, it's rare that they say, oh, well, so free software gets funded because through people working on other things. But it's very common when you're when you have a talented team of software engineers and you're using a tool to simply add a feature. And as you say, you have an incentive, your organization has an incentive to get that software patch upstream, if for no other reason than, you don't want to have to repatch the software going forward, right? That alone is motivation. It's a pain to integrate patches into software. So you want that to be upstream. You want that to be in the quote unquote real version, if possible.
It's kind of funny. We actually didn't slot anything in here for this, but there's an unintentional upstreaming that also happens. That's been GPL enforcement, actually, where a company didn't plan on releasing things upstream, and then it turned out they had to. And that is kind of funding some free software stuff. It's not the best method when it's unintentional usually, but it does result in some free software end up getting upstream.
Yeah, that's true. That's the whole idea of some of these licenses. Although if it's purely an internal tool, that's not distribution, and that's a whole another legal discussion. But let's bring it back to academia and this idea. I think many people are under the impression that academic institutions are kind of charitable actors, and software that gets just written inside of an academic institution is automatically free and open source software. And that's not true.
Right. I think like any other employer, they're technically your employer, and they technically hold a copyright over your work. If you are doing this, funded, like work for hire for that institution.
Right. And sometimes that work will get distributed as free software, but it's not an automatic process. And academic institutions, especially in the United States, and then especially recently, have oriented themselves to make profit from their research and their work. And so The idea that they're going to just give things away is probably less true now than it has been in the past. Nonetheless, there is a lot of software that gets written in academic institutions and then distributed and maintained that way.
Yeah, I don't actually know any numbers about whether or not that's on the increase or the decrease. It would be interesting if we could find some data. If any of our readers have data or listeners have data on that, we would love to hear it.
And of course that gets tricky too, because you know there are more. It's kind of this. There's a statistic that I heard, and I don't know if it's true, but there are more blacksmiths now than there ever have been. And you think, well, why would that be the case? And well, because there are more people now. So even if blacksmithing is not as important an occupation, just by the virtue of the number of people. The number of people in that profession has increased. So academic, we'd have to adjust for that too. But that would be very interesting to read.
But we've spent pretty much the whole time of this academic thing so far correcting against a view that, you know, academia, you know, doesn't necessarily produce free software, but still quite a bit of free software does come out of academia, at least in some circles, right? So language research, especially, I'd say.
Programming language research.
Yeah, programming language research. So a really good example of this is Racket, which one of the Racket grad students I've met described Racket as being largely funded by an army of grad students hacking away at Racket, right? So, and I recently had the kind of the privilege of visiting Northeastern's language research lab, and it was pretty impressive the number of, you know, people who were, you know, Racket contributors who were also working on all these interesting software projects. And in general, that lab has a lot of freedom to push things you know, out in the open as free and open source software.
And I would say also that that's generally true in the computer science arena, where the line between research and code are so complex and nuanced. You know, for example, if you're working on code, you know, if your research involves the Linux kernel, well, then your code, if you want to distribute it, has to be under the GPL.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And I think there's also another interesting part of academic research, which is there is a movement and push of people to have reproducible research. And a great way to have your research be reproducible is have it be free software and also have it be buildable by other people and executable by other people. So especially if you're in computer science, but even outside of computer science, and that's been a large portion of the drive of the increase of it was originally called IPython Notebook. What has it been renamed to? I'm trying to remember the name.
Jupyter?
Yeah, Jupyter Notebook is a, you know, which is both a, it's kind of like org mode in that it had, except for people on the web who are not Emacs users necessarily, where, you know, people can collaborate, pardon me, on documents and can include code that can execute. And it's very popular in the scientific academic community as a way to be able to, you know, include statistical information and all sorts of things right into your document in a way that's very highly collaborative. And because of that, we've seen at least the fundamental infrastructure of Jupyter Notebook and other things like that. You know, I think, you know, there's been some, I would assume quite a bit of contributions have come upstream. Actually, I haven't verified this, but I know that I know some people who have been pushing for, well, if we want to do reproducible research, then free and open source software is the way to do it. But of course, a lot of code that comes out of academic papers, like a lot of it, is not actually buildable or runnable by the general public. It either never gets released or actually just ends up being some dump that effectively nobody knows how to compile.
Yep. Yes to all of that. So I you know, there is a movement generally within academia to move to open research, whatever the field. So I think computer science is a little bit ahead in that code is the way that computer science research often happens. And free software is very much part of that. And I think it's hard to get away from free software if you're doing any kind of computer science-y thing, especially on a budget, as grad students often are. So software gets developed in this kind of charity way sometimes, by both companies and academic institutions.
And since we sometimes, so we're not just a software freedom podcast, but we're user freedom in general, I think we also step into, there's also been a push that we should probably mention about from academia, largely, sometimes actually very much so driven by the people who write the books or who are teaching. What we might call open educational resources. And those are, freely licensed, usually under, one of the Creative Commons licenses, although not everybody ends up actually choosing one of the Free as in Freedom Creative Commons licenses under that label, but that's a separate issue. But but what is interesting is that there's a push there similarly, open educational resources in academia, and that's not software itself, but it is. And I have two good examples of that. One of them is called the American YAWP, which is YAWP, I think. I'm verifying that. Yep, and that is an online and collaboratively built American history textbook, which is fairly progressive and is, you know, freely licensed. And there's another one, which I am forgetting the name of, which is an operating systems textbook that came out of the University of Madison that's fairly popular, which is an open educational resource. And there's other ones as well. And I think this stuff is great. And academia is a great fit, right? So a lot of these journals and publishing organizations in academia are just straight up predatory, where they will take... you publish an article and then you no longer actually have the rights to your own article anymore. That journal has rights to your article and you have to lease it back from them. The original author never gets paid. It's bad for them and it's bad for the community, but there's a pressure to do it. So there's a movement in academia to say, hey, you know, this academia is a great fit for making these kind of changes.
Yeah. And I think when we're talking about educational resources or software, it's really very much the same thing in that it's the same benefits. It's why do we have to pay for something over and over again when we can just have it once and then all use it as many times as we want.
In the age of digital distribution, both educational resources and software are non-rivalrous goods.
Right. And we talked about those issues of rivalrous versus non-rivalrous, and we talked a little bit about marginal cost in the previous episode. So we can just reference it in this one, and if anyone hasn't heard the previous one, they can go back.
Yep.
Okay. Yep.
Oh, sorry. You want to go ahead?
No, you do.
Okay. So the next topic is we touched on this a little bit. With the mentioning that the Document Foundation with LibreOffice has the, you know, click here to donate thing, but there's a more direct form of the donate when you acquire access method. And I think that two examples that really come to mind to me are Ardour and the Blender Market. So Ardour is a digital audio workstation. And if you go to download it on their website, I'm going to actually just click through the process right now. So I go to ardour.org and I click get Ardour now. And it says download programmer source code. And it says, you know, the ready to run program or source code you need to build it yourself. Okay, let's assume that I just want ready to run. I click that. What select the operating system? Well, I suspect if I select GNU Linux, it's going to give me some package manager's instructions. So I'm going to click Windows just as an example. I click that, select my system architecture, 32-bit, sure. And I click, yes, I want that. And then it gives me payment choice. And it says subscribe, your choice 1, 4, 10, or 50 per month. Updates and downloads as long as your subscription continues and access to nightly development builds. Or single payment and then just get that version that I download, or get the free/demo version, which periodically goes silent after 10 minutes, or upgrade to 5.12 and there's an upgrade process. And there's an FAQ thing there that says, I thought this was free software. And it says, Ardour is free in the following ways. And it says, basically the free software type philosophy thing. And it says, you know, we like to say Ardour is free as in free speech, but not as in free beer. And if you want the convenience of using the ready to run version, you need to pay for it. And I think that this is interesting because, you know, again, this is a place where they're kind of you're being kind of directly they're much more so than, you know, LibreOffice saying, you know, yeah, pay up.
Yeah. I mean, and I'll admit, when I first saw this, I was a little bit offended. I was like, well, gee, you know, that's against the spirit of what we as a community do. There's nothing stopping someone from making their own build of Ardour and releasing it. It's free software. So, you know, if you or I or somebody listening were motivated, they could set up a little build server. They could build the software. They could put it out there and everyone could build it. So what's the motivation for someone to go ahead and do this? Well, there's two motivations. One is convenience. You know that if you're going, well, you presume that if you go to Ardour's website that you're getting the officially good build and there's no bad things added. And you're supporting the organization that created the software in the first place.
Yep. So I mean, you know, we do say in free software, there's nothing wrong with, and in fact, it's even encouraged to charge for software when you can. And so it does seem very weird to me, but I don't think there's anything wrong with this. It feels weird in that, it feels weird in that actually kind of, I think the thing that feels weirdest to me is that there's a certain amount of incentive that the funding come from places that are not kind of the free software operating systems. But I don't think that it's wrong. It's just very strange.
Yeah, I guess where I want to talk about other organizations that have done similar things. I think that for someone like you who's brought up concerns about reproducible builds, I would have questions about reproducibility in a project like this that's saying, well, pay us and we'll give you a build. I'd question their commitment to reproducibility. But
yeah,
that might also just be on me, right? That there's no evidence. I have no evidence that any of the organizations, I don't know if there are others other than Ardour that do this, but that anyone's actually making this harder, although it does frankly de-incentivize them from making reproducible builds. It's slightly de-incentivizes. But another organization that's done us a similar thing is the Free Software Foundation. When they were distributing their software on tape and on disk and sending it to people, that's a very similar model. If they were sending out binaries along with source code, that's exactly the same model. It's a convenience thing.
Yeah, and we talked about this a bit in the first episode, but the FSF was originally funded, and actually most of GNU, a large portion of GNU, the foundation of GNU that we have on our systems was paid for because the Free Software Foundation paid software developers, and they paid them to work on what was considered the most, you know, there were a lot of volunteer contributions, but people paid for disks and they paid for manuals, and that helped pay for GNU. And when the internet came around, that became like there was less of this. Hey, you know, there's less of kind of a middle process in the same way that there is this middle process where you're visiting this website and it's like, hey, pay up. You know, there's a similar thing that happened with, you know, like, hey, or maybe we can even say, hey, please pay up, right? Like, you don't have to, but like, you know, you should pay up here. There's a similar thing that happened when you got tapes back in the day. And that doesn't exist anymore with the way that GNU is typically distributed. So I agree that it does have a very strong similarity there.
Yeah, and I guess that's the question in my mind is this unethical behavior? You know, the term you used in the previous episode was ransomware, and obviously this doesn't fit the definition of ransomware. That it doesn't fit the definition.
It doesn't
that you
fit the
used
definition,
the previous...
but it does sound more ransom-y, I agree, even though it's not a related topic.
Yeah, or is this the equivalent of sending you a tape or a disk in a world where we have the internet? Is building a binary for you the equivalent? Because frankly, you could make this binary. Presumably, you could make this binary yourself if you had all the tools and you spent the time setting it up. You could have it. You could set this up and distribute it.
Well, and if you're a user of a free operating system, you do get a binary just handed to you, right? Like, you know, Debian or Geeks' Build Farm or Fedora or whatever. They've got a package you can just download of an Ardour, and you don't have to do anything. It's just there.
Yeah. You know, I guess we didn't think about this, Chris, but this kind of ties into dual licensing in a sense.
Well, okay. So I don't agree that, well, I agree that it has a weird feeling that's kind of similar, but I think that but there is no relicensing here, right? It's the same project.
It's the same work.
It's the same work. And that's a big distinction. That's a big distinction.
But I would say it's spiritually connected in that you are creating an artificial barrier for non-free software users.
Yeah, that's a weird thing is that it does have some connection to non-freeness that is how it gets there. Like, which is that it's non-free operating system users that are kind of in the middle. And we talked about whether or not free software app store or like free software package managers could do a similar thing, but they aren't currently. And you know, I guess it also ties in. Here's another direct tie-in. You know, what if you buy Wesnoth off of Steam, or what if you get, you know, or something else like that? Like that is,
well, Endless Sky is a game that we talked about in our games episode recently, and it is available on Steam.
Right, and that's a proprietary app store on which you can get some free software, and you can pay for it there, and now it's a revenue model, but that revenue model is now tied to having some sort of proprietary thing. And it seems so strange to me because, like, you don't actually really need a proprietary thing in order to have this, but clearly it is working for people to have that, you know, that kind of artificial aspect does help incentivize people to pay for some reason. And that does, I think that also, it kind of bugs me not only that the proprietary thing is there, but also that I feel like, oh, we shouldn't need it though. And yet clearly it is providing incentive for people to pay up.
Yeah, there's lots of potential reasons that could be the case. So
I want to mention one more in this category, mm-hmm. actually, which I think is really interesting, which is which is a thing called Blender Market. It's not actually run by the Blender Institute / Blender Foundation, in my understanding. It's run by a separate company, which I think is CG Cookie, and they do a bunch of training materials and stuff like that, which I think are, you know, not open content training materials, but they have this Blender Market e-store type thing where you can go on and download a bunch of content and you can download plugins, you can buy plugins, but Blender is under the GPL. So when you buy those plugins on there, they have a requirement on there that they be GPL compatible, which means that you technically could take stuff from the Blender Market and just, you know, distribute it separately from the Blender Market. But people are paying up there. And I think that that's kind of interesting. And I don't think that the Blender Market would be doing this if it weren't for the fact that Blender is under the GPL. And I don't think that many plugin authors would actually be doing it either, because there are a lot of plugin authors that are like, cranky about the fact that they have to give back.
Do we want to jump from, because this Blender market thing makes me, sorry, this Blender, I forgot what you called it.
A Blender market. So this is not run by the Blender Institute, but are you thinking we should jump to the other Blendery stuff we talked about?
No, I was thinking that this tied into WordPress.
Oh,
and
yeah,
the fact
sure,
that WordPress is also GPL'd, and that there are a million plugins out there that are not free software, even though they legally should be.
No, they aren't legally, and they're violating the GPL is what you're saying.
They're violating the GPL.
Right. Also the case with Drupal. But
yeah,
legally,
I mean, maybe that's a tangent that because we're not actually talking about GPL violations, rather we're talking about funding free software.
Right.
It just made me think about, well, my thought process was, gee, I wonder if there's something in the Blender Cloud terms of service that
Blender
says,
market.
Oh, even though the
two
software...
Two different things, Blender Cloud and Blender Market. We'll get to Blender Cloud
okay,
later.
Sorry. So Blender... So I wonder if there's something in this Blender market that says, oh, if you distribute the stuff that is GPL'd, you are violating the market and we'll kick you out because they're not legally allowed to do that.
I don't believe so. From what I've talked to somebody who is a free software enthusiast and has sold a couple things on the Blender market, I think, and they seem to think that the Blender market people were being legit, they were complying and being good actors with the GPL, but you know, as far as their requirements go, right? But mm-hmm. I think they also don't like overly advertise that this stuff is free software and that you have these rights and
right,
stuff like that.
Right, right. Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that's good to hear. That's good to hear that this company is being a good actor in the space, and I'm very glad that that's the case.
But it is funny that they're well, and I should check again, but I think that it's not very visible that it's, you know, that it's free software and that stuff's, you know, that it's free and open source software. So,
but it also brings up an interesting point, when we talk about this convenience, which is, well, why isn't someone just deciding to turn around and redistribute it, right? So if I was an Ardour user and I was bothered by this binary thing where I had to pay for them to for this binary build, even if I paid, I could turn around and say, oh, by the way, I don't think you should have to pay. And I could turn around and offer it on my own website. So why don't people do that? But again, I think we're going down a rabbit hole rather than talking about the funding.
I mean, there's another interesting rabbit hole, which is since anybody can charge for something like Blender itself, there are also kind of scam companies that do just switch the name on Blender and then actually sell it and don't inform people there either. That I guess that's a completely different tangent. Two interesting tangents that we should not go into right now.
That we should not go into, fair enough.
So I'm clicking around on the Blender market thing, and it does mention one of these things says royalty free as the license, and it looks like the license is mentioned. The license is mentioned, GPL and stuff like that, but you know, the default but it does say, you know, $40 purchase and like, you know, $15 light version. And you're right. Like somebody could take all this stuff and just dump it somewhere else. But I think this actually ties into the thing we were talking about in the first episode, where we also know many people who do use proprietary apps, who use proprietary game distribution services and other proprietary app stores who are perfectly capable of not paying for it and also not complying with the legal requirement set out, you know, quote unquote pirating it. They're perfectly capable, but they choose to not do that anyway because they want to fund the development model. And I think that that's actually a source of inspiration here, which is that if you put up this type of thing, you say, well, you should purchase, people are purchasing, especially if you don't just say, do you want to purchase? But you just say purchase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So we've talked about this sort of convenience model. We've talked about this. I would say this Blender thing is kind of in between. It's not pure convenience.
the Blender market.
The Blender market. It's a little bit more ransom-y, but it's not entirely. It's somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think ransomware. We should not blur. Even though it sounds convenient because of how ransom is, we should keep ransomware as a specific thing.
Fair
which
enough.
Is where it's done, but in order for the public to get it, the public has to raise enough money.
Fair enough. I agree with you. I won't abuse that term any further.
Okay. But I agree that there is an aspect where, you know, you're still being told you should pay up right here, this point, and then you get it.
Okay. So then we've talked, moving on a little.
Why don't we move into, you had a good segue with WordPress there. Maybe we should talk more about the next topic.
WordPress is interesting. So there are a whole bunch of companies and these at this point, we should say that fundraising is often not, exclusive to one, approach. So, they might, you know, an organization might take one approach and another approach at the same time, or they might take, you know, two or three approaches. They might say, oh, donate to us. Oh, and by the way, we have this other thing at the same time, and there's nothing wrong with that.
You and I have both bought books from the FSF, even though we also have donated to the FSF.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about so there's a whole area of free software companies or free software projects that have a hosted option. And so let's define that a little bit. So what we're mostly talking about are programs that run, on a server somewhere.
Right.
So WordPress is an example of that. WordPress is a content management system. It runs a lot of big websites and blogs, and it runs on essentially a web server somewhere on the internet. And WordPress itself is free software. You can download it and run it on your own computer. You could set up your own server somewhere. But they offer a service, a commercial service, where they will run WordPress for you. They will run it on their computers, and they'll handle all of the complexity of managing a service like that for you for a price.
Yep. And so this is kind of the service approach when we talk about, so there's some server that's hosting things for you. As you said, it takes care of the complexity. And WordPress is actually a pretty good example of a good actor, actually. All their stuff's under the GPL. They're serious about the GPL. The stuff that they host, they don't do as far as I know, I don't think they do an open core type approach. The stuff that they release is the same, you know, like, I don't think that, you know, the infrastructure hosting, you know, meta software is necessarily free software, the internal stuff, but the WordPress itself that's running is free software, and it actually funds WordPress upstream. Right. So that company actually does the development of WordPress itself and is largely funded through hosting WordPress sites.
Yep. So there's a lot of terms we've kind of bandied about here. I don't recall if I used the word self-hosted. Self-hosting is basically when you basically run it yourself. Use the term open core, which I think we'll define that a little bit later. In an ideal world, hosting a service based on something that you've created is a great idea. I think it's a really nice idea in theory. The one caveat I have to that is that it creates a fiscal incentive to making your software hard to self-host. WordPress is a good actor in that it is easy to run WordPress. It's super easy to run WordPress, and they make it easy, and they give instructions on a number of platforms. But there is a financial disincentive to making it easy.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's an interesting thing you bring up there. It's kind of the classic job security type thing where somebody, you know, like intentionally made, but I actually can't think of many examples of projects intentionally making themselves hard to host for that reason, but I think you're right that there is an incentive for it. So other projects in this category, another one that's pretty clear to me, I think, is NewsBlur. I haven't really looked at NewsBlur in a while, but I know quite a few people who, they got really big after Google Reader shut down, and it's a similar web-based, you know, feed reader, and kind of absorbed a lot of the Google Reader enthusiasts who were frustrated when it shut down. And I think they're running pretty much the same software that they're hosting. I haven't verified this. I don't know if they have proprietary extensions or if they've maintained that, but I think that was the case a number of years ago. I think it still might be the case now. And OpenStack is a weird case. OpenStack is actually more of the 501c6 trade organization that kind of has a bunch of companies paying for OpenStack development together as a pool, or it was. I don't know if OpenStack's as big as it used to be. I mean, like, a few years ago, OpenStack was like the hot shit that, oh, okay, I can't, another,
you can curse. I mean, we've already decided that occasional cursing is okay. We don't curse very often.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, OpenStack, the hot shit at one point. I don't hear about it as often, but you know, that was, you know, another thing where, and I don't think anybody really ran a completely the vanilla open version of OpenStack, ironically. I think that almost all vendors, including Rackspace and et cetera, had a modified proprietary version. But it is an interesting example where there was funding of OpenStack because people were hosting OpenStack.
Yeah, that's right. I think we could have a whole discussion about why OpenStack isn't as popular, but that's not relevant to the matter at hand. Do you want to talk about GitLab? Because I think they're an interesting segue into something that you talked about earlier, which is OpenCore. Or do we want to wait on that?
Why don't we hold off on GitLab and save it for the OpenCore section? Because I feel like that's such a huge topic. I'd like to give it some space. Okay.
Yeah. So want to talk about advertisement or premium placement?
Sure. So, you know, a good example of this might be,
let's talk about what we're talking about first, right? So
yeah, okay.
Before we talk about examples, let's define some terms.
Okay. Define.
So you're using a piece of free software and you might see an ad in the middle of that free software. That's very unusual. Having used Windows, you will find that at various times, just there'll be an ad in the middle of a program. That is not something that we in the free software world are used to. We're not used to seeing ads in our programs. It just isn't done. But more subtly, there's situations in which a service is prominently featured either as a default or entirely disableable. So let's talk about Firefox, the Firefox toolbar and search bar. The way that the Mozilla Foundation, one of the ways that they fund themselves is that they auction off who can be, what your default search engine is. So you type a term and it will take you to that search engine for the results, and companies bid for that. And it was Google for a long time. I think it may be Bing on some platforms. I think it was Yahoo for a short period. But that's something that a company can pay for if they want. And then the other one that comes to my mind was in Ubuntu Unity. Their toolbar, when you searched it, also searched Amazon. I don't know if it still does that, but the big deal there was that it was not something you could disable.
Well, yeah, and that one was very troubling too, because people might search in for private files and then Amazon was able to find out information about that user that may have been very private stuff that the user was not even aware that those queries were going upstream.
Yeah, and also it's somewhat contextually, We in the free software world are not used to that, are not used to our private information even possibly being leaked in that way. And it wasn't something where you could easily, you know, flip a switch, run a command and turn it off. It was intrinsically built into the software and built hard to remove.
Yeah.
So, well, that's an example of, but obviously that there was a financial, agreement in place. It wasn't just that Ubuntu and Canonical thought, oh, this is what the users really want. They were clearly paid for it.
Right. And I actually think that the Firefox thing doesn't bother me that much because it's pretty easy to switch. And also when you do a search, it's more clear to me that I'm going to be doing a search across the search engine. The Unity thing bothers me a lot more because it wasn't made clear to the user. It wasn't really a search for the benefit of the user as much as it was. Well, I'm not sure a lot of people are not happy with the Firefox default search thing, but I think that to me, it feels a lot more defensible, than the Unity thing. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I agree with you. I mean, I think it's similar to, there are plenty of situations where, there might be a piece of free software where, it might say, oh, if you need something extra, for example, okay. So the example that's coming to my mind is Nextcloud. So Nextcloud doesn't do hosting. If you use their, I think if you use their app there's an option that says create an account. And then you're like, well, what does that mean if they don't have hosting? Well, it'll take you to a list of hosting providers. Now, I don't know if Nextcloud pays, has a relationship by which those listings are advertisements or not, but it wouldn't surprise me and it wouldn't bother me if that were the case.
Yeah, I think we'll have more things to say about Nextcloud in a moment. Just a couple more things on this ad stuff. So the Firefox default search thing is funny because it kind of is ad-ish, but it's a little bit functional. A more explicit version of ads is, so I actually don't know if Wikia contributes upstream to MediaWiki. It would be interesting to find out.
MediaWiki is the software that runs Wikipedia.
Yeah, it runs Wikipedia and it runs a bunch of other wikis out there. And that is one thing that is interesting though, is that Wikia is another example of a service thing where it's hosted by somebody, but you can pay for a service such as WordPress by just paying the WordPress company, but the way that the Wikia things are paid for is by ads, right? So that's a different choice on how something can be paid for. And it is completely possible to run a free software hosted type thing where you switch out the hosting, the paying for hosting for advertisement. But there are a lot of people in the free software space who are not comfortable with advertisement because of, the surveillance capitalism type aspects to it. There have been attempts to make advertisement things less icky. I think the best example I've ever seen was Project Wonderful, where you just paid to have something on a website for a day and you didn't get any information about who the specific people were that was on there. So it was relatively surveillance free. But Project Wonderful ended, and pretty much all ad things today, I think, are very surveilly. And I think that adds to discomfort about that kind of advertisement model. And a really uncomfortable thing that a number of, some projects have used is something called, at one point there was something called Open Candy. I think it still exists, which is classified by as malware by many groups, which, they kind of sold themselves as, oh, if you've got a Windows binary, why not wrap it in the Open Candy installer and we'll install adware on your computer, on the person's computer. And that, that's the most uncomfortable version to me of the, of the let's get our money through people who are on proprietary distributions, because that one feels more exploitative than just, hey, pay up at this point.
Yeah, and you bring up a really interesting and important distinction here. I think for many people, this advertisement and the nature of advertisement has changed. Advertisement of the past was passive, right? It was a billboard or a page in a magazine. And what we're talking about now is not just a display of an ad, but data collection. And so it's a lot more sinister than the type of advertisements that I think some of us think about when we just think about advertisement. We think about what we see rather than what's being done under the covers. And so really what we're talking about is capitalizing on on private information.
Right.
And I think that's the really disturbing part. I mean, there's an aspect of, oh, this is annoying to look at, but the spying aspect is the part that gives me the willies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we move on to the next one, which is support.
Yeah, I think this is so let's talk about support. Support is basically, hey, I've written this piece of software and I'm an expert on it. And if you would like help with it, pay me. And there are, I think this is from the very beginning of free software, a model that was thought about and adopted. The big two companies, and of course now I am blanking on the original one, the one that I'm thinking about was Cyclades Software, which was a company that was maintaining CVS, the version control system.
And also Cygnus. Cygnus.
But Cygnus is the one that I was blanking on, so thank you. Yes, yeah, so Cygnus, which was maintaining basically all of the, well, that you could pay to get support for the GNU tools.
But the way that they made money really was support for it on Windows especially. They had the Windows release. So it comes back again, you know, it's got this proprietary operating system tie-in in a way. But they didn't just do that. They also did, my understanding is they also did, companies wanted extensions to GCC and stuff like that, and they could pay Cygnus and stuff like that to add it. Is that right?
I don't remember that. That's a little A before my time and not a company that I knew much about, but you might be right. I definitely know they were doing support.
Yeah.
We're talking about support.
Don't take the thing that I said as fact, because I actually was not very active when Cygnus was, before it was acquired by Red Hat, or I don't remember when it was acquired by Red Hat.
It was acquired by Red Hat pretty early on, I think, like in the mid, late 90s.
Okay. Well, that's a good tie in to the next one of a support.
Right. Which is Red Hat?
Yes.
Yeah, so Red Hat's a pretty classic example of a company that sells support, right? The reason that you go to Red Hat is that they have produced a product that is well tested and integrated, at least presumably, and then you pay them for their expertise, for their help if something comes around. That's basically it. In some ways, they're in.
Companies want somebody to pay. In many large enterprise organizations, are used to and expect the ability to pay and call up somebody when something goes badly, and to have updates, you know, effectively paid for.
Yeah, and there are whole industries, sort of cottage industries around. Having people in your organization who are certified in that software, in that whole galaxy of software. And Red Hat has done a good job in doing that. They have also, although there were some times that they pushed the limits, they have always produced 100% free software.
Yep.
So there is nothing, even on the server end, that is non-free that they create.
And then now that's an interesting tie-in to IBM for another reason as well. Because IBM's the other big historically free and open source software support organization, starting in like the early 2000s or late 90s is when I think they started pivoting into that, right?
Yeah, but I want to hear what you have to say about IBM.
Well,
because I don't know much about them in this area.
Well, it's because they bought Red Hat, right?
Oh, right. Okay. I thought you were going to talk about their own. I thought you were going to talk about their own history in free software.
No. I mean, I think they've been also doing support. They're not as good of an actor as Red Hat in that they do proprietary software. I think sometimes it's been, you know, they've been often a good actor, but not always. And sometimes it's hit or miss. But I think that, and that's why the acquisition of Red Hat by IBM, I think kind of hit home for some people about like, oh no, what's this going to mean? And that's mainly because, and right now it appears that Red Hat's kind of still able to do its own thing and stuff like that. And IBM's kind of just, you know, letting them be fairly independent. But, you know, I think there is some worry from people in the community of, you know, Red Hat's been such a good actor in the space that we hope that that's able to be preserved.
Yeah, and I think it's a good idea here to contrast this this support, because it can get complicated, because Red Hat's very much on the good end. They're very so where they've been a little bit tricky is that they have it's not that easy to strip their trademark out of their software. And make a derivative product that is not Red Hat, but that is essentially Red Hat. And that's where they were a little bit, there was some contention. But, you know, if you compare them to a company like Canonical, Canonical, which produces Ubuntu Linux, is, Ubuntu is free software. At least some versions of it are, and there is some non-free software that gets bundled. Usually in the form of drivers, but Canonical has proprietary server software.
Yeah.
So
it's also interesting in that both Red Hat and Canonical have also had this kind of community, have had a corporation and a community on the side, more so historically with Canonical, I feel like, than now. Right. So in the mid-2000s, Ubuntu was kind of, I said hot shit before, so I get to say it again. It was really hot shit, you know, like, in fact, a lot of people, you know, Ubuntu was synonymous with them for GNU Linux. And there were all these Ubuntu loco things and stuff like that. And similarly, Red Hat has, you know, the kind of community version of things is Fedora. And Red Hat as an organization has been very supportive of Fedora. But that community, a lot of people there are employed at Red Hat, but there's also quite a few community members who are just enthusiastic community members. And sometimes that can get contentious, but very oftentimes I think there is a kind of synergistic relationship. But I think that, you know, actually, I know that we have some people who are listening to this podcast who were, very enthusiastic about, you know, Canonical and Ubuntu, at the time that the loco stuff was really big and feel like it did not go in a great direction eventually.
Yeah. Something that when you're talking, I was thinking about was that both of these companies have produced software that is not in their direct interest. So in the case of Fedora, the kind of business customer that Red Hat has is not going to necessarily be as interested in some of the UI stuff.
GNOME.
And yeah, essentially GNOME, right? If you're a large, you know, financial institution, you don't really care that much about GNOME, but GNOME is something that Red Hat has funded through Fedora, essentially, which is in a lot of ways their experimental or community version of the software. Even though, you know, even though again it's all free software, this is where they put out more of their I don't want to say avant-garde. I'll just say, you know, experimental stuff.
Well, and it's the community that kind of refines what ends up becoming actually the next release of Red Hat.
Red Hat, yeah, that's right. Red Hat Enterprise Linux, because yeah. That distinction is a little different. Going back historically, there was a distribution called Red Hat Linux, and that distribution doesn't exist. It kind of split into two, one being Red Hat Enterprise Linux and one being Fedora.
Yeah.
Ubuntu is a little different in that there is only one Ubuntu, and then the company will support certain releases. So they'll have certain long-term support releases of Ubuntu that they support. But again, it's not directly in Canonical's direct financial interest to start developing certain software features, and yet they do pay for it.
But not to the degree that I'd say Red Hat has. And I think that they did so more historically than they have recently. But I think we don't really want to get into the, you know, kind of.
Yeah, no. But what I'm saying is that these support companies have an interesting history within the community of also creating new features and supporting other things.
Yeah, that's true.
That there's this relationship, and that's what I'm thinking about and wanting to focus on. And the other example that I was thinking about, and we talked a little bit about privately, was Nextcloud. So yep. Nextcloud is a company that makes it's hard to explain what exactly Nextcloud is. Nextcloud is a platform for self-hosting a number of services, starting with file management, but also communication platforms, so video chat and also calendaring, and also they have a social aspect.
There's yep. It's running activity
office collaboration.
Yeah, it's actually
Nextcloud Social is. Yeah.
Yeah, so now Nextcloud, so actually, well, I mean, I'm biased in liking Nextcloud because I had many good interactions with its founder Frank, blanking on his last name at the moment, but he was actually one of the big early supporters of ActivityPub at the W3C back when he was actually working under OwnCloud. But recently Nextcloud shipped ActivityPub support, so you can it's now a member of the Fediverse, and they seem like one of those institutions. So obviously that biases me in their favor, but they actually seem like one of the institutions that like is one of the, you know, good actors that we can point to and be like, hey, look, you can do this stuff, and here's a really nice example of a company that we think yep. is good.
Yeah, they're great. So that's the support approach. So let's kind of moving on. We talked a little bit about the container model, right? Where you're basically the stuff inside the disk is free, but the disk isn't free.
Not Docker style containers. Let's be clear.
Yeah. No, we're talking about
distribution medium.
Right. So, you know, so if I give you a CD-ROM full of free software, well, the stuff on the CD-ROM is free, but I might charge you for the CD-ROM itself or the USB key or whatever it is. So those container models are not as popular as they used to be because the internet has made that a lot less useful. But people do sell, and organizations do sell, cool stuff related to free software. So the FSF sells little, you know, they sell t-shirts and they sell stuffed animals and they sell printed versions of manuals. Even if those manuals are out of date, it's because you want a physical reminder of your connection with the organization.
Yeah. Yeah. And, and it's actually, so, one of my favorite examples of this was, so I've talked about Blender a number of times previously, and the last time I mentioned it on this episode, I mentioned Blender Market, which is not run by the Blender Institute / Blender Foundation. But something that the Blender Institute has done is all these open movie projects. And I think they are really cool. That it's a whole episode in itself about, you know, why I think those initiatives are great. They release the source code of the movie as free software they release the source to the movie in the way that we do with, you know, free software, which is pretty cool. They also release, release the actual, you know, compiled movie alongside it. And that's pretty interesting. And it's all under, you know, free culture licenses. But what's also interesting to me is that, the Blender Institute, has these big open movie projects that go hand in hand with the development of Blender itself. So, when one of these movies, so like, as an example, Big Buck Bunny, which was this kind of, you know, furry and funny style movie and starring this rabbit and these other animals, they needed fur tools and they needed better animation tools. And they had developers sitting alongside the artist who said, and the artist would say, we need this stuff. And the art, and then the developers would say, okay, and get to work on actually pushing that stuff out. And it's a very direct, interaction between a user base that's directly sitting next to a development that we haven't seen a lot. But the way that they originally funded that was by shipping out DVDs of these open movie projects. And now, shipping out DVDs is not as profitable as it used to be. So what did they do? Well, they set up something they called Blender Cloud, which is a, you know, I think it's a something like $10 a month or somewhere around there subscription service where you can go on there and it's got all free culture. I think it's all, maybe not 100%, but at least mostly free culture, movies and assets of stuff used to produce those movies, and also just assets you can use in general, that it is behind this paywall. But you can actually find a lot of it outside of that paywall, probably even all of it. But people are more than happy to pay for it. And actually the Blender Institute is doing pretty well. You should check out a video to see what a big space they've gotten and they've got some videos up on their YouTube channel and like how they've got some cool projects going. And I think that's an interesting example of transitioning from that kind of, you know, selling physical goods thing to the digital realm, while actually preserving, the user freedom side of things.
Yeah. There's a lot there. And, I'm surprised we don't see more of that, but I guess Blender has the advantage of the stuff they make being very compelling. I'm thinking there are other animation software programs out there that might be able to use that same model, but you're right. Blender is kind of special and that they've created this relationship with the community.
Yeah. I'd love to see something like an open game project that's run with like the Godot people and the Blender people interacting or something like that. I think that that could be really cool. You know, I'd love, or maybe an Ardour, you know, a movie, an album that gets released where, you know, the Ardour team works with that group. I think that this is an interesting way to advance free software and make it seriously good, is to have a funding model where there's some sort of output that's directly connected and working alongside the development of that project.
Yep. So moving on, we talked about features, and actually you just brought up features and new features in Blender. You know, there's an idea in outside of software circles with non-developers that software is really, really hard, and only a very few people that have written the original software can possibly edit it or modify it or maintain it. But that's actually not true. And a lot of software development happens, or modifications happen, within an organization. So, In organizations that I've worked in, where we had talented programmers and system administrators, if a piece of software had a bug or was missing a feature, it could be added by the developers internally. And it was often cheaper and easier for us to do that than anything else, that meaning than to either try to procure some other software that did exactly the same thing plus the feature we wanted, or to try to go out and pay for that development. It was just easier to take our existing talent and say, hey, spend a few days or a week adding the thing we need, including me. I've done that.
Yeah.
There was a bug in some backup software, and I fixed it and sent it upstream.
Yeah. It does happen sometimes where there are institutions that offer, you know, you can pay us and we'll develop new features. I actually have participated in that before, where I've both paid for things and also been on the recipient of being paid, but it's rare. Like, as in terms of having an organization that is the developers and somebody's paying them to develop something specific, it's pretty rare. And that actually starts to tie into the bug bounty stuff, which we'll get to soon. I agree that most of it ends up happening internally. And actually, so this is kind of interesting, because we talked about this at the beginning, kind of tying in with the 20% project type thing and kind of that idea of that. There are also times where organizations will decide that they use some software and they want somebody really dedicated to getting some things upstream. I know of at least one Python developer who, at least at a couple points have, a couple of Python developers have been paid to work on Python as a core part of their job. You know, just work on upstream Python features. You know, this has happened with Guido did that at Google, and there is also Dropbox paid for some of the typing stuff inside of Python.
I think there's a couple. I want to say there's a couple pieces to what you're saying. So first of all, there are also times that an organization will pay for a developer to be there on staff, not because they want the source code upstream, but because they want someone who's an expert in that piece of software itself.
Yeah.
So that issue of upstream is not necessarily on the forefront. The question of whether software changes should be sent upstream, and what we mean upstream is to the original development team, and to be part of the officially blessed version, is that it over time reduces maintenance cost.
Right.
There's a benefit. I just want to say there's a benefit to an organization to have their stuff sent upstream.
That said, many organizations might be resistant if it's not in their culture to pushing things upstream. And we had an episode recently with Karen Sandler where we talked about the contract patch initiative and how it can be really important and useful at the time of you negotiating your contract to work that in, to make it explicitly clear that you are going to be releasing your stuff upstream. And I think that ties in with this bit.
Yep. So you want to talk about, is that the same as paying for maintenance or bug bounties, or
should
we see that separately?
So it's kind of funny, because I think people get much more excited about paying for new things and they get excited about paying for maintenance in general, right? It's very exciting to hear about the cool new features that are coming into your software, but most development time is not spent on new features. If you want your software,
maintenance is boring, and it's much more fun and interesting to have new things. Which is ask my dentist about that.
Yeah, right. So it's but the sad reality is that maintenance is actually oftentimes more important than new features, and yet it doesn't get the same amount of attention, sometimes to dramatic detriment. I know you had a couple examples in mind.
We talked about NTP and libopenSSL.
Oh right, on the previous episode,
In the previous episode, and those are our core pieces of software. But you can there's hundreds of others. Software bugs are, they happen, and they're quite common. And it's important that there be a constant, effort to maintain, not just when a bug is found, but hopefully before bugs are found, or before bugs get into the released versions. I mean, that's the invisible, you know, the best kinds of problems are the ones that the people never see, right? They get fixed before they hit the public. And you know, but I guess, but what's
sorry, I
well,
I when you said invisible, I was not sure what was coming, and I had this vision in my head of the invisible foot of the free software market, as in keeping things running.
Oh.
I don't know why I laughed and interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Well, my question is, it's okay. You didn't laugh at my joke, so I'm glad you laughed at something I said. I guess I don't really know about this as a funding model. We talked about that at the end, I guess, where at the end of the last episode, where I said I believe that governments should be funding this. And we are seeing companies getting together and saying, okay, it's in our collective best interest to fund some of this stuff. But that's still not happening very much.
Right. OpenSSL and GPG being good examples of stuff that got funding because everybody realized, oh crap, all of our stuff relies on this and we need it to work.
Yep. So I think toward the end, we're going to talk about non-free, because here we are sort of at the end. We're starting to...
We've got one more. We've got bug bounties.
We got one more?
Yeah.
Bug bounty, you're right. We got bug bounties.
Yeah. We should define bug bounties. Actually, there's two different classifications, I'd say, of bug bounties. There is the original vision of bug bounties, which was a very free software oriented thing, which was, you know, we've got all these bugs. Some people want specific ones to be fixed. And they'll say, hey, whoever can pay for this thing, you know, I put up this money and whoever fixes it first, you know, get some money. And actually I did this recently, in Geeks, GUIX, I recently put up a bug bounty because I was having, trouble with some stuff, where I couldn't get certain Racket libraries installed on Geeks. And I said, okay, I'll pay somebody if they can fix this problem for me. And sure enough, somebody stood up, they fixed it, and, you know, I paid them. And it was my first experience actually doing one of those. I did immediately run into one of the challenges where I felt guilty because somebody else started researching and did some work trying to figure things out, but they weren't the one that completed it. And that gets into an interesting thing about bug bounties, which is, you know, what happens when there's intermediate effort, in the bug bounty? How do you split that up? I mean, in this case, I think that somebody started doing research and then another person really brought that work home. But it could have been more extreme where somebody did half of the work and then another person completed it halfway, and, you know, and that might be harder to split up.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. Yes. Oh. Bug bounties, which is, by the way, the structure that the European Union has chosen is a bug bounty program. I guess the other type of bug bounty that you're going to mention is the kind where you offer a financial reward for finding bugs in your source code.
That's right. And actually, this is very popular right now in the proprietary world, where proprietary services. So, and actually, I guess proprietary software also in general, where Facebook will, for example, and Google will pay people if they find an exploit in their services. You know, well, it's much better to pay some security researcher than it is to have somebody just exploit it and make money that way. And what's also interesting to me about this is that this is a very different kind of bug bounty when you think about how it's presented and worked on than the bug bounties that we originally discussed. And one of the big differences is the original form of bug bounty I mentioned, somebody has selected a bug that they would like fixed. And in this case, you don't know what the bug is going to be. You're just saying there's definitely bugs in here, and it's almost always security related. And you say, okay, if you find that bug, you know what? I'll pay you. We'll make that exchange instead, and then I can fix up my thing. And it's interesting to me because it feels like this is being very successful in a way that the original free and open source software vision of bug bounties has not really been. And I wonder why that is. I have some thoughts, but I wonder if you have thoughts.
I do. I'm wondering if it's relevant, because we've got a lot to talk about. But yeah, I would say that security finding security bugs is fun, and it has some mystique and appeal in that way.
Yeah, and I think also traditionally, bug bounties. I know some people who tried to get their living off of bug bounties for a while, and one challenge they ran into was that it could be challenging to kind of hunt down the bug bounty once it got put up and once they fixed it, and having both parties agree that it was satisfactorily fixed.
Yep.
Okay, so let's move on to the big one. You wanna?
Well, there's a couple big ones. I think there's OpenCore, and then there's, I would say, dual licensing is a second part.
Right. So Or what we also sometimes call proprietary relicensing. So let's make a distinction here. Well, I mean, they're really pretty similar, though, aren't they? Or do you disagree? Why don't you define?
I disagree. I don't think they're similar. I think that they're. I mean, look, everything is similar to some extent. So let's start defining terms, and maybe something will come out of that. So open core is the idea that you have some piece of software, it's free software, and then you have, you can do this one of two ways. You either make a community edition and a quote unquote enterprise edition or a premium edition, or you say, well, the main software is free, but we'll create some proprietary extensions, and the extensions will be non-free. The way this is often sold being by the company, or the way they talk about it, is, well, you know, you regular people, you only really need the community version. 95% of the people only need the community version. And it's only for the, you know, the big customers, either the proprietary software using customers or the big enterprise customers. They always sell it with those two groups in mind. They're the ones who need our deluxe edition.
So GitLab here is a good example, actually.
Yeah, you want to talk about it?
Well, I mean, okay. GitLab has GitLab's community edition, and then they have the enterprise edition. Enterprise edition has a bunch of enterprise-y features that many people... that are non-free, right? And actually, what's interesting in this case is that the GitLab is under a lax/permissive license, and the extensions are under a proprietary license. There's no relicensing that's happening because the core thing is does not require reciprocation in the first place. The way the copyleft requires it. So and one other, so this is kind of an aside, but one thing that kind of bugs me is that the proprietary version is also developed out in the open. Actually, I would rather not have the opportunity to accidentally run into non-free code that I could see that's under a proprietary license, because that actually worries me more than it just being closed off and I could never bump into it.
That makes sense. And this is a pretty common model for, especially for hosted software or for software that's, again, supposedly meant for the enterprise. And look, in a completely ideal world, this would be totally fine.
Ideal world, we wouldn't have proprietary software, but.
Right, we'd have a proprietary software, right? So, but you one could make an argument that this was an acceptable compromise. I don't think it is. And I think that it has a number of problems. The first, and I think the most significant, is that it de-incentivizes things to be in the free version. And I have seen examples of enterprise edition, including features that they said, oh, only large enterprises will ever need. But That's just not true. It's basically anyone who wants to run this in a serious way. And I forgot. I wish I remembered the software that I was looking at, but it was the community edition did not have LDAP support, but the enterprise version did. And I was thinking, but I needed LDAP support, even though it was a small system. It was the way all my users were stored. It's a user management system. It's a kind of like Active Directory. And, I was like, oh, well, I can't use the software. It's not usable to me. And it was annoying to me that the features that I wanted and needed were already developed. It was basically ransomware in that sense. It was ransomware that will never get released.
Right. I think that's not ransomware again. But
okay. All right. Fair enough. I will stop using that term. I love that term so much.
Well, it's such a good visual image.
It's hot. Can I call it? I guess I can call it hostageware. It's the same thing.
Okay.
But you know, it's, hey, we have this and you probably are already running this software because it's free software. It's almost like shareware in that way. It's like, we'll give you a little teaser.
I agree with that. It does have a shareware type connection there for me.
And I'm just, it just makes me uncomfortable on a number of levels. And
I agree.
Yeah, keep going.
Well, I mean, okay. So I was actually just piping in to agree.
Okay. And I guess the more I think about it, the more you might be right that OpenCore and what did you call dual licensing? You called
it proprietary relicensing. It's not usually that you end up having two licenses just sitting there. It's very frequently, oh, you'd like to incorporate this with your license. Let's work out a licensing deal for you.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So let's define this for people. And I think I can point out where the distinction is. So if you're working, if you've got a piece of software that you want to release under proprietary license, there might be a free software library that you want to integrate, but you can't because the license prevents you from doing so. So under a proprietary relicensing model, you'd go to the free software developer and say, well, we'll give you a lot of money if you can make a version of this that we can integrate with our proprietary software.
Right.
That's basically it. And the prime example in my mind is the Qt library.
Well, historically, do they still do that?
I don't know. Do they? I didn't know they stopped. Okay. Maybe they have.
I'm
I don't
not
know.
Sure, but I do remember that. But you're right that that was a model that was made available under Qt at least at one point, or I guess it's actually technically pronounced cute, which is really strange.
So the
general idea, yeah, so you've got the general idea there. So you know, maybe I like using game examples, so let's pretend there was a nice game engine that was under the GPL, and I wanted to make a proprietary game and sell it. And I'm like, oh, but now I have to release my game as free software, and I don't want to do that. And so now I go to this, you know, game engine, you know, the place where, and I'm like, okay, well, since I'm making a proprietary one, let's work out a license deal where you actually give me the same code, but under not the GPL, under something that's accommodating of my proprietary games license. But you'll notice that in order to be able to do that, the organization that developed the software that's under the GPL has to have the copyrights to the entire GPL software.
I was just going to go there, which is that this model demands that the copyright assignment from any contributor be given to them, which creates the exact type of one-way relationship that the GPL itself was specifically in its manifesto and preamble were designed to fight against.
Yeah, I go back and forth on this, mostly against, but sometimes I'm like, I don't care too much, and then like I'm like, oh yeah, it is a problem, you know, like the so I have gosh, I don't actually know whether or not to quote this person on the somebody, if they agree that they would like to be quoted on the episode, I'll add it to the show notes, once said to me, well, I actually think it's not so bad because doing a proprietary relicensing is like a syntax, which I thought was a funny pun on syntax. But, you know, like you're paying a tax to be able to do your proprietary syn. And so that's not so bad. And like, yeah, I guess I kind of agree, except, you know, I remember when I contributed to, I got a patch upstream to, what was the name of it? It was some localization platform, and I can't remember the name of it, that we used for Media Goblin, and also when I was at, and I contributed a patch to this localization platform, and they're like, will you do the copyright assignment? And I said yes, and because I was like, it's just this very small patch. And then they went proprietary, you know, and then relicensed the whole thing, and nobody bothered to keep up a fork from where they left it off. And that kind of left a bad taste in my mouth, you know, like, oh, like, man, like, you know, I guess that was always a thing that could happen, because it wasn't just that then they kept a proprietary relicensing thing. They actually just decided to take the whole thing from that point forward as a proprietary project.
Yeah, and I think where, you know, you're getting at is, as you say, like, somebody could have forked it. They've chosen not to, but the social construct in which you made your effort to them was one in which, you know, you had certain assumptions,
right,
and that they violated their those assumptions to you. If they had come to you and said, Chris, we will accept your patch, but because we may take it proprietary or we'll use it, we're going to give you money, you know, would you accept, you know, $1,000 or something, then I think your attitude might be a little different. But I mean, I don't know, but at least for me, it would be different, because at that point we are establishing that this is a for-profit proprietary commercial endeavor. But when you have to make copyright assignments to a company that may take your work proprietary, then things, it's unfair from that angle.
Yeah, it creates a power imbalance that the copyleft was designed, as you said, copyleft was designed to prevent.
And I think the core difference between open core and proprietary relicensing is that open core is for services, and most often for services. And proprietary relicensing is for libraries.
Yeah, I would say that's I think that there's been a whole bunch of back and forth on that term open core with you know, and what the heck does it mean? But I'm happy to. But I think that you are making two distinctions between two things, and I understand what the distinctions are that you're making. But I also want to get back to so that whole, you know, you pointed out that this kind of was antithetical to what, you know, copyleft was designed to, you know, prevent. And I think that this actually becomes an interesting tie-in to the very start of this conversation we had in the previous episode, which was that copyleft is designed to, you know, so that, well, we didn't say this, but we talked about, you know, the free rider problem and Tragedy of the Commons. And most of this episodes, or these two episodes, we've been talking about how to avoid the free rider problem and how to prevent you know, just one person paying for all the stuff and getting kind of, you know, not, you know, and bearing that cost without, you know, having the rest of the community help with those resources. But, you know, when we talk about the Tragedy of the Commons and that field where people are putting their sheep in, and some people are taking advantage of that sheep and kind of whittling away at it, to me, it feels like copyleft in many ways is meant to prevent the Tragedy of the Commons as opposed to the free rider problem, in its, you know, the free software enthusiast version of copyleft. The free software enthusiast version of copyleft says, oh, look, we don't want this commons to be worn away. We want this commons to survive, you know, and in order to prevent it from being whittled away, We've set up this license agreement that makes sure that everybody's fair in that space. And there's a different, and that's to protect the commons. And there's a different incentive that people who want to do proprietary relicensing have about copyleft, which is actually about the free rider problem and not tragedy of the commons type thing, where they're saying, okay, the way to solve the free rider problem is to embrace proprietariness by having that one person who pays the ticket up front, you know, they have some sort of deal with the rest of the passengers that come on or something like that. They're trying to prevent that. They're trying to prevent that one person from paying up front. And while I totally agree with and understand the idea to do that, the way that it's using copyleft is not to preserve the commons. It's to set up a financial arrangement that is dependent upon software being proprietary. And you might be able to say that's okay with the syntax side of things, but it sets up an unequal relationship with the community. And that's where the real problem comes in my view.
I agree. I'm thinking that we're kind of near the end, but I want to touch on one more piece. We hadn't discussed it beforehand, because it didn't occur to me really until these last few minutes. But everything we've discussed so far is 100%, even if it makes us uncomfortable or we don't agree with it, it is free software. But lately there have been attempts to misuse the term open source to things that are not open source and they are not free software. And publicly to attempt to stop the free rider problem. And I'm specifically thinking about the Redis license and a little bit the MongoDB. Although MongoDB has still stayed on the side of free software, Redis has decided.
Wait, have they? I thought that the server side public licensing they were looking at was it's being debated about whether or not it's free, but it seems non-free to me.
It's non-free. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Everything we have talked about thus far, including proprietary relicensing, is acceptable, right, as free software in the sense that you are allowed to do this and it meets all of our criteria as free, right, software. The Redis, and you had the name of what they call this.
Well,
thing.
The server side public license one is the MongoDB one, actually, and the other one is the I think it's something community license or something like that. I should look it up. But it's a very double speaky type term where what's happening right now is we're seeing, you know, that there's a term called open washing, which is where you make something look like it's kind of free and open source software-ish when it's not at all. And, you know, that term's borrowed from greenwashing where, you know, stuff like the BP logo looking very green and even effectively giving people the impression that the BP company is environmentally friendly, even though they're not. A very similar thing happens, right, where because open source is cool and developers seem to think that it's something that they want, companies are pressured to deliver on the open thing, right? But these are companies that are now actually saying, wait a minute, we're leaving money on the table by having things be open. Let's pivot outside of free and open source software. And they're not calling it proprietary software. They're pretending that it's open source software. And that's where it's a big problem.
Right. And I saw this a lot in the 90s where companies would say things like, well, this is open software. I saw made with open source software. I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Microsoft had a term for this, actually. They were calling it shared source software.
Yes, shared. Well, that was they had that too. There's been a number of attempts to degrade free and open source software. And so the reason I think this is important is it connects directly to your free rider problem. And what I want to say, and I'm pretty sure you're going to agree with me on, is whatever we believe about the free rider problem, it's never worth breaking the social bonds of free software over.
I agree 100%. So I think that So, yeah, I think that brings us pretty close to a good wrap up. So the summary is, yes, we'd like to fund free software. There, we've covered a lot of options, actually. And there may be even some that we missed. You know, feel free to contact us if you think of one that you can think of that we didn't talk about. And it also seems appropriate to me, as we're ending this episode, to mention that we're still in the phase of some of these nonprofit fundraisers for free software stuff. And now is a good time to, even though we've passed the end of the 2018 fiscal year in the U.S., it's still a good time to, you know, help get some of these organizations over the line, because funding free software is important.
Yeah. And if you're listening in the future, it's still important. Yes. Whenever you're listening to this,
it'll be important.
It's right. Important. you know, get in touch with us. By the way, so since this is our, well, I don't know what episode this will be when we finally release it, but, we'll definitely have under 10 episodes. We are absolutely looking for your feedback. We are LibraLounge@floss.social. You can write to us at podcast@LibraLounge.org.
We should say that the LibraLounge at floss.social is not an email address. That's the account you set up
right,
on Fediverse.
That's right. That's our Fediverse account, and you can post to that if you're on Mastodon or one of the other Fediverse systems. And yeah, our email address is podcast@LibraLounge.org, where you can drop us a line. You can also find our contact directly on the website, LibraLounge.org.
And
we are really looking for your feedback. Pound Libre Lounge on Freenode. And I believe that someone has set up a Matrix bridge, and we should talk about that at some point. Yeah.
Please give us feedback.
There's so many ways.
We have gotten feedback, but like, Serge and I both keep saying, like, you know, what are people thinking? Like, what do they think about this show? What do they like? A lot of the feedback has been, that was good. And, you know, we'd be happy to hear, you know, what specifically was good? What specifically could be better? What are you interested in us covering?
Yeah. And if there's specific topics that you want to hear, we would really love that, because that'll give us some direction where we want to take the show. Yep. So thank you. And just please send us your feedback, and please keep listening.
And now we should really wrap up, because we're about to hit, between the two episodes, 3 hours of talking about fundraising. So we hope you really like the idea of funding free software, because you just listened to a bunch of it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Take care, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on OpenGameArt.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Hey, I'm Chris.
What? Oh, I'm Serge, I guess? No. Backwards.
I actually screwed that up. Not on purpose.
Hey, we finally get to put in one of those after the episode we screwed up things. All right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I actually ended my recording, so.
Okay. Well, we're going to keep that.